Let's go through every single package installed with a Linux install image. I'm going through the software included with Slackware, but these are all open source applications and libraries, so whether you're running Slackware like me, or Fedora, Debian, BSD, or even Mac or Windows, you can probably download, install, and try these on your computer. So chances are, you'll be able to learn something from this podcast. Let's get started. And we're starting with media-player-info. Yes, that is correct. We're doing a package that does not start with lib. That is very, very exciting. Media-player-info is not strictly a library, actually. It is stored in the /lib directory, but it is not, strictly speaking, a compiled library. Instead, it is a series of .mpi files, which are just ini files. They're little configuration files with square brackets followed by key pairs. And the thing that is, I'm just trying to grep for something really quick. Here we go. The files exist as ways of describing media players, as you might have guessed from the name of the package. So for instance, here's a media player called the Philips Go Gear Opus. Opus is unrelated entirely to the codec, but it's funny. It's a funny example to use because it's recognizable and yet not recognizable. So anyway, I'm going to /usr/share/media-player-info/Philips_gogear-opus.mpi. So this is one of the files included in this package. And it says square bracket device, square bracket product equals Go Gear space Opus. So that's the product name. Vendor equals Philips. Access protocol equals storage. So this is going to be seen as a storage device, or it wants to be seen, I should say, as a storage device. That's the default setting for Go Gear Opus. It's using that MTP protocol, probably, that we were talking about, I don't know, a long time ago, in the lib MTP section, probably. Square bracket, media, close square bracket, input formats equals audio/x-wave, output formats equals audio/mpeg, audio/x-ms-wma, audio/x-flac, that's cool, audio/aac. Square bracket playlist, close square bracket. Formats equals audio/x-mpeg-url. Square bracket storage, square bracket playlist path, playlist path equals playlists. And then audio folders equals music, semicolon video, semicolon record, all in capitals. So you can kind of see how this, I mean, at least if you've ever owned a media player, you can kind of see how this kind of describes or could describe a media player that you yourself could might come across at some point. You know, it's a product. It's got a vendor. There's a certain way of accessing it. It accepts wave input because it has an inbuilt microphone. It has an output of MPEG and WMA and FLAC and AAC. It has playlists that you can use of a specific format. Here's where those playlists would be stored on that device. Here's where the music files that you would want to play back would be stored, or the recordings that you would want to play back. Oh, yeah, you can also do video. So This is describing the capabilities of this media player. The question, obviously, I think, is why? How does your computer know what to do with this .mpi file? Well, there are configuration files stashed in user share media player info. And I did say that some of this was kept in lib. So the other component of this is indeed in lib/udev/rules.d. And this, these rules, of course, are associated with UDEV, which is the hardware abstraction layer, sort of, except not, it's UDEV. That was kind of a weird reference to before UDEV, there was HAL, hardware abstraction layer. HAL I didn't love, although to be fair, I was still kind of a new Linux user when I had to deal with HAL. This was back in Slackware, like 12.0, 12.1, maybe 12.2. I imagine, I don't believe Pat would have switched to UDEV in a point, in a dot release. So surely HAL would have had to been around for 12, 12.1, 12.2. And then 13 must have been the start of UDEV. It's really funny to think about. the fact that I was a new Linux user three versions of Slackware ago. But if we measure it by Fedora time, it's 30, something like 32 versions ago. That's weird. That is a little bit weird to think about. But I mean, it's accurate, right? I mean, that's the Slackware guarantee. You will be able to look back just a couple of versions and barely remember like what Linux was like back then. And then you'll, yeah. So anyway, UDEV, what it does, and this is kind of an interesting thing, is UDEV sits on your computer. Obviously, it's software on your computer, and it listens for things being attached to your computer. It probes that device, and then it allows you to sort out what to do with that device based on a set of rules. Now, I will admit, I'm quite happy with UDEV. I think it does its job really well. I will admit the rule syntax, I don't love the rule syntax. I do believe it could be a little bit more elegant. But it does its job, generally speaking. I'm not convinced that it restarts when I tell it to restart. I'm very much all about rebooting your computer if you're changing your UDEV rules. That's just, I do not believe it will work without a reboot. That is my belief, based on a lot of testing. So it is good, though. I mean, I see the logic behind it. I see what it thinks it is doing. I see what it's meant to do, what it's designed to do. I quite like it. So in /lib/udev/rules.d, there's a 40-usb-media-players.rules, and it has a series of actions that it's listening for, because you can have different kinds of actions that UDEV could detect. For instance, you could add a device to your computer by plugging it into your USB port, for instance, or you could remove that USB device. You can ignore the remove, right? This UDEV rule, if you're removing a media player, this UDEV rule doesn't have anything to say about that. That's not what the media player info package is all about. It wants to detect when a media player is attached and then do something based on what media player it is. And the thing that it's doing is it's associating that MPI file with that device. So these rules, it listens for an add or a change action. And in fact, it says the very first line is action !! add pipe change go to media player end. So it is saying if the action is not either an add or a change, then go to media player end. Like, just go to the end of this file. And the way, this is one of the things that the way that you sort of provide markers in the UDEV rules is you make a label equals media player end, and then you just have nothing after it. It's a little bit awkward. I don't know, don't love it. I also didn't write UDEV, so I mean, maybe that was just the easiest way to do this, and I understand. I wouldn't want something more complex than it had to be. So then the next line here is catch MTP devices. That's a comment. But so what that's saying is that the environment of the dev type has to equal a USB_device. So if UDEV is monitoring something, and if you attach what other kind of ports are there? An audio. Does it detect audio? Surely it detects audio. Yeah. You plug in an audio cable that's not USB, then it's going to ignore it. In this case, it doesn't care about that. It's only going to catch the devices that are classified as USB_device. And it says explicitly, in that case, if UDEV detects that, it's going to go to the label of media_player_start. And it goes on like that for a while, but I mean, the meat of the script is that it's looking for the attributes, specific attributes. So it's got ATTRS curly brace vendor close curly brace equals quote asterisk for a wildcard Apple close asterisk close quote comma, and then attributes for the model would be iPod, and in that case, then it's going to create an environment setting ID media player equals Apple_iPod. So that's the quick and easy way to detect for you, Dev, to detect whether, you know, is this an Apple device? Well, if it is, then it's going to give it the label or the environment variable Apple_iPod. And now everything that needs to know what this thing is can just query for an environment variable and discover, okay, it's an Apple_iPod. Got it. And there's a couple of others that get explicitly listed in this rule. For instance, there's the Motorola phone version 3i or something. There is a Series 60 phones for Nokia. There's any Rockbox media player. There's Sony PSP. I don't exactly know why those get called out. I'm guessing because the ID product values, the firmware that gets burned into that device by the manufacturer, I'm assuming because they must have either just one product ID for a bunch of different models, or because they have too many product IDs to count, maybe. That must be something like that. So it must just make sense, like, okay, well, these just give them this label, you know, just give them this environment variable to identify them, because it doesn't really matter whether it's a Slim or a Nano or a Pico or a whatever, an Opus. It's one of those things. Whereas for the other set of things in that you could possibly plug in, there are in this package there's the HWDB file in libudevhwdb.d/20-usb-media-players.hwdb. So HWDB is a subsystem within UDEV to provide really just the most frequent use of UDEV, probably. Possibly, like, it's a really common function to be writing a rule for UDEV to say, okay, if it's this vendor and this product, then label it as such and such, or give me permissions to access it as a normal user or whatever. So to just associate a product ID and a vendor ID to a known quantity, to a thing, you can use a hardware database. It's a key value store for associating mod alias like keys. I don't know what that is. That means this is from the man page of HWDB to UDEV property like values. It is used primarily by UDEV to add the relevant properties to matching devices. It almost makes more sense if you just look at the file, because it's really obvious what it's doing, I think. So again, that's in libudevhwdb.d20-usb-media-players.hwdb. And it does, you know, the first line, comment. Is that the first line? Yeah. First line, comment, liquid. Okay. So this is like an Acer device called Liquid. USB colon V0502P3202 ID_media_player=Acer_Liquid. ID_media_player_icon_name=multimedia-player. All right, picture that, except how many times? 3,000 times. Call it 3,000. So lots of them. I mean, they're actually, it's probably a lot less than 3,000, because every single item has three or four lines associated with it. So let's say 1,000 times. It's a lot, but that's the syntax is, hey, if you detect something that comes up with this metadata, because this metadata got burned into that physical device by the manufacturer, then label it as this thing, give it this icon name. And the thing that it's being labeled as, of course, maps back to the MPI files included in this package. And so UDEV is able to mark a player that you've plugged into your USB port as a specific player according to a hardware database, and then it is able to, or and then other things that might care are able to look for information about that specific thing. So if you're writing a media, you know, like a podcatcher or a media playing application that you want to be able to sync back and forth to a media player, then you know now that you can use, that you can query ID underscore media underscore player. That's the environment variable that would be associated with a media player. Grep for that name, Acer underscore Liquid, or Apple underscore iPod, or whatever. And then from there, you can look up the MPI file to find out what you need to know, just by default, what do you need to look at this storage device, or at this media player device as? Is it just MTP storage, or is it something else, some other protocol? What library needs to interact with, and so on. That's what USB media player info does. And like I say, I think UDEV is I think the rules are a little bit clunky in a way, but I think that overall, I think it does its job really, really well. And I've been pretty happy with it. I mean, I don't get like really excited about having to write a UDEV rule. That's never happened. I never think, oh, cool, now I get to go in and troubleshoot UDEV. This is going to be great. Much more excited when something just magically works. That's really nice. But I mean, that's just not realistic. You know, I mean, like, new hardware not listed in UDEV, or you know, no one's come up with a rule for that yet, or whatever. You just have to mess around with it. The point is that once you kind of understand how to do UDEV, how to write that rule, what you need to be looking for, then it does eventually work. Like it's dependent upon your logic, your understanding of certain conditions within UDEV. I think that my main problem with UDEV, I think, is that it's really difficult to sort of, like, you think of UDEV as a cause and effect, you know, like if this device gets added, then do something. But in the syntax of the UDEV rule, there doesn't really seem to be a differentiation between the if and the then. Action equals equals add, comma, go to equals blah. That's kind of common, because like if the action is add, then go to this label. Okay, that's cool. But it can get a lot more complex than that. I mean, even if it's just action equals add, blah, subsystem equals block, ID, or yeah, attribute equals, or you know, attribute ID product equals 0001, attribute ID vendor equals 0008, comma, my string, close curly brace equals blah. Where's the then in that statement? I mean, it's the last one, I guess. Like, I guess you could think of that, but that doesn't say to me that that's a then. That just says that that's just more, possibly that's more stuff to look for. I don't know. Looking at it, it's difficult to differentiate like the parts that are querying a device or parsing data and setting new data. I think that's my main thing about the UDEV syntax. Moving on to mhash. Mhash is a C library that helps you create a hash. We talked about, I think, hashes a little bit and salting and things like that a while ago. I don't remember if we just talked about the hash part. I don't know a whole lot about it, so it's going to be quick. First of all, confusingly, and I'm sure that there's a good reason for this. They're probably related mathematically or something, but hashing bizarrely has two different definitions in programming, in the programming world. You can make a hash as a map, or you can hash a thing. Like I say, I'm sure they're related. I'll bet someone out there who knows the low-level sort of theory but underneath all of this stuff will know. But for us sort of generalists, it can be a little bit of a confusing conversation point. So you can make a hash map or you know, just hash. You can be hashing something, and you're saying, okay, well, here's some things, and here's the data that relates to those things. And how do you keep track of object A, data set A, object B, data set B? How do you associate those to one another? That's a hash map, and that is a valid use of the word hash. The other use of the word hash is a technique, this is a mathematical process of generating a definitively a fixed size output from something that is of an unknown length. So for instance, if, well, the simple one, I guess, although, I mean, I wish there was a simpler one, but the simplest one would be echo, quote, hello, close quote, pipe MD5 sum space dash dash text. I don't know if you actually need the dash dash text. Yeah, you don't. So just echo hello pipe MD5 sum. That takes the word, the string hello, and does some math functions to produce a file that is, or not a file, a number that is roughly 36 and then minus a couple more. So I don't know, let's say 32 digits long, give or take. I'm not counting them, but I just did a WC-C and it came out with 36. There are some extra characters in there. So anyway, let's say 32. That seems likely. 32 digits long. Now, that's the word hello, right? So if I do the word hello world, which is longer still, I get a different number, but it's still 32 digits long. And I could put in hello world, this is a beautiful open source day. Still 32 digits long. So I've got variable lengths of input here, and I'm reducing them down to a string of hexadecimal, you know, this number of hexadecimal number that is 32 digits long, no matter what. It's a little bit magical, and you can kind of imagine doing that with some kind of function of what is it, like, I guess is it 3 or 9, or I guess both. 3 and 9 are pretty fancy, right? Because I think, no, it's 9 that I'm thinking of, where the sum of the two digits, if it's divisible by 9, always add up to 9. So you could imagine, sort of like in a super simple, like, elementary grade level mathematics understanding, such as is my understanding of math, you can kind of imagine how that would work. You know, you could probably come up with some really poorly implemented and very inefficient way of taking a string of digits and maybe translating them to numbers through some kind of, you know, Caesar script, and then adding them up until you reach, you know, 2 digits every time, or 1 digit every time, or something like that. I mean, not, it wouldn't be the best way of doing things, because then how would you unhash it? But you know what I mean? Like, so it's a mathematical thing where you take things and you reduce them to numbers, or you interpret those numbers, run them through a function whereby in the end you have 32 digits to represent that thing. And if anything changes about that, then that number changes. So if I do echo hello through MD5 sum, and I get B19 blah 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 184. That's great. That works. But then if I do echo hello with a capital H instead of a lowercase h, just one little tiny change, then I get a return value of 09F blah 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 3B3. So completely different number with just one little tiny change. Something that you might not even think would even be that big of a deal. I mean, it's the same letter, right? Well, of course it's not really. Change the O to a 0. Again, totally different. It might look the same, but it's totally different. So this is obviously something that is used a lot when you're downloading files from the internet, because and you want to make sure that you're getting the exact same file that the author claims that they posted, then you could use this. And I mean, I calculate for whatever good it is, I calculate the SHA-256 sums of each episode of this podcast, in fact. So if you were ever unclear as to whether, you know, if one of the episodes cut off in the middle, and you think, oh, did I not download the whole episode? Did it get truncated somehow? You could, in theory, do a SHA-256 sum of your file, and then go back to my website, GNUWorldOrder.info, and look at the SHA-256 sum of that I believe I posted. And if they're the same number, then yeah, you might want to email me and tell me, hey, you only posted half an episode. Or if they're different, then you would know you didn't get the file that I posted. You got something else. Maybe part of it. Maybe something that got corrupted in the transfer. Whatever. It's not the same. So. So that's the practical use for that. And mhash is the way that you would do all of those things through just in your C code. Next up is MLT. This is a video editor. MLT. This is the back end for video editing. And it's a really, really useful library, as it turns out, because not just one, not just two, but at least three open source video editors are based on MLT. And I think when you start to see that, that's kind of, that says something, you know, like that's a thing about open source is you start to see the proliferation of a component throughout lots of different iterations, and you realize just how useful this model can be. And this is an interesting one, because you might, the counter argument to that, which I think a lot of us have made sometimes in the past, and because it's easy to fall into this, the counter argument to that is, well, why do we need three? Well, like, why, if there's a video editor and it works perfectly well, like, why bother with three of them? Let's just put all of our efforts into the one. And that's because not all video editor humans, like the people actually editing, using the applications, we're not all necessarily the same. We don't all like the same thing. And so the fact that you can use Kdenlive Live and you're using MLT on the back end, you'll never know you're using MLT, but that's what's happening. And someone else can use FlowBlade, and someone else could use Shotcut. They're all based around MLT. I mean, that's huge. That's a big deal, because that means that there is one effort going into the editing part, that's the MLT, like that's what's actually doing the heavy lifting. And then there's a whole other set of efforts going on in making the application itself look and feel and act in a way that someone happens to like better than another way. Kdenlive Live and FlowBlade offer drastically different experiences. I default to Kdenlive Live. It really is kind of the steadiest going right now, and has been for a while. Shotcut is really cool, and I do need to look at it again. I kind of got away from looking at it. But I should check another, I should take another look at that. As far as I know, Shotcut is made by the same guy, Dan, as the person who works on MLT. I could be a little bit wrong about that, but that's as my memory serves. So yeah, it's really cool. And MLT also has, as you can see from the package list, it also has, my history is a lot longer right now than I realized. All right, so var log packages MLT. There we go. MLT also has a command, melt-7 specifically. And melt, the melt command is the terminal version, the version of this, of all of the functions that MLT provides through its libraries. It also provides through this command. Now, the command, I don't think it is intended as an actual terminal editor. Like, I don't believe that's the intent. And I say that because the first line in the documentation for Melt is, Melt was developed as a test tool for the MLT framework. So I don't believe that they intend for this to be a sort of deliverable, you know, release target. I mean, it is a release target. It exists. You can do what you want. You can use it as a terminal-based editor if you want. I have had mixed results with it. I can get it to do things, but it doesn't, when it plays, at least on my current Slackware system, it doesn't actually play. It just sort of, it shows a window that is a copy of whatever is behind it, and it appears to be playing. Sometimes I can hear the audio, but it doesn't play the video. I've tried piping it through AV format. I've tried lots of different things. It just doesn't seem to work. So that's been my experience right now. And that, again, this is just the terminal component. So, you know, Kdenlive Live works brilliantly, works perfectly. FlowBlade works brilliantly. Like, no problems. It's just Melt, the command, doesn't seem to know what to do with the clips that I feed it. In theory, though, it is very cool, and the idea is that you can tell it to play a series of files, one after the other, and suddenly you've got a movie. That's what a movie is. Like that you've now edited clips together. But there's more to it than that, of course. You can set the in and the out points of those clips. You can set filters. You can set the transitions between the clips. You can create video tracks and list different tracks, put different video on different tracks and composite them and all kinds of things. So there is quite a lot you can do with the melt command. I think what the melt command, for me, what it's missing is any concept of a workflow. So for instance, if you're actually editing video in your terminal, you need to know, like, you're not going to just know the in and out points naturally. You don't know exactly when to cut in and out. So you're going to have to audition the clip, and then you're going to have to mark your desired in and out point for that specific clip. And then you'd want to work that into your edit, and then you'd want to output to some kind of render file eventually. And I don't know. So I think the workflow that does exist is super obvious and easy to understand, really. I mean, it's you just melt, that's the command, and then clip one dot opus, no, dot webm, clip two dot webm, and that's it, you know. I mean, or you could say, like, well, you can do all the things that I said, you can mix them, you can transition between them, and so on. So I mean, it's And that's all you do, is you list it in the order that you want things to happen. And it kind of works, right? I mean, it's just really obvious. That is, if you can get it to play on your screen, which I cannot apparently right now. So it is kind of, there is a certain beauty here to that. I just, for me, to take it sort of seriously as a terminal editor, which is in itself kind of funny, because nobody takes a terminal video editor seriously. Like, nobody's looking for that. It's just, it is a workflow that is not optimal, really. Like, the most obvious thing to do with clips of video is to put them into a video editing application so that you can audition each clip and then mark in and out and then put them in your timeline and so on. I feel like there's an established workflow that just kind of makes sense. I do personally feel intrigued by the concept of editing video in a terminal. I actually used to do it quite often when I was teaching film courses. There would be times where I would need to string things together. I've done it even more recently than that. I had to do I did a fan edit of a horror movie because I didn't like the intro. So I reworked the intro, and I couldn't be bothered to bring it into a video editor. And I just did it in a terminal, and it worked great. Not with Melt. I did it with just FFmpeg. I used to do it with MPlayer. So yeah, it's a thing that I think does have a place. It has its use. And I think with Melt, the command, I think, obviously, the intent, I think, is for them to be able to test different Melt files. Melt, MLT, the whole thing, it just speaks in XML. And so it creates these files. And if you look at like a KDN Live save file, it's all XML. So you look at this and it's got different, you know, it has XML with names of clips, the endpoints, the outpoints, all of the different things around it. And then Melt, or MLT rather, interprets that and ideally should be able to play it back for you. And in theory, unless the application developer has done a lot of very customized things with their application, like a quote-unquote pure MLT editor ought to be able to just, you should be able to pass your melt file from one editor to the next. Now, I know that Shotcut and the melt command are, you can pass those two back and forth, the last time I checked. I don't know if the same is true for KDN Live and for Flowblade. It might be. I haven't looked into it. But MLT is very cool, and it handles like the in and out points. It handles the concepts of video tracks and of filters. Filters are things that essentially are fed a frame from some source, from a producer, as they call it, and then that filter gives you a frame back with something, probably with something changed, something's altered, like maybe it's been composited, maybe it's been turned black and white, maybe it's been flipped or flopped, whatever. That's what a filter is, and that's cool, because that then you can do video effects and things like that. So MLT is I mean it is video editing on Linux, to be honest. I mean, it really is. It is the back end for video editing on Linux. So if you're using Flowblade, which you're probably not, Kdian Live, which you probably should be, Shotcut, which you can, then you're using MLT. I don't know what's the Open Broadcaster, OBS. I mean, that's not strictly speaking, it is a video editor, but nobody thinks of it as a video editor. I guess it's a video mixer. I don't think that's using MLT. And what's the other one? OpenShot. I don't think that's using MLT, but I could be wrong about that. I mean, it's not listed on MLT's website, so I don't know. Yeah, it might not be using MLT. I don't remember. But it's a big deal. MLT is a major force in video editing for Linux, and we're really, frankly, just lucky to have it. It's just such a nice little toolkit. So I think I'll stop it here. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next time.